Tailwind Nutrition has become the drink of champions.
I like that, Scott. The drink of champions. Tastes great, less filling. Remember that old ad?
What was that?
Miller Lite. Tastes great, less filling. And I kind of think about that when I think about Tailwind. It does taste great, and it doesn't feel like it loads your stomach.
So that you get those gut bombs.
That's it. So it
stays light and fresh and fruity.
and some of the flavors are fruit, with the exception of Naked. Naked's kind of just a smooth going, you know, evening nightcap, if you will.
I was I was out of state this past week, and I was going for a run with a customer of mine.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, you need to try this. I had three flavors. I had the unflavored.
Right.
I had the lemon, and I had the berry.
Which one did you give him?
I let him choose. He chose the berry, and he went, wow, this stuff is great. And I said, not too sweet, huh? And he goes, you know what? I really like this stuff.
Did you mention the word savory? Because that's always a word that fits.
You know, I don't think I knew what the word savory meant until Tailwind Nutrition came along.
And I imagine there was a bit of a conversation about tastes great, less filling?
I'm sure that came up. Tailwind Nutrition, it's found in a lot of the races around the at least the western United States now. I know there's a lot of people that are using it.
It's back east too, Scott.
I think it's around the world. And you know what? People are using it. People are converting to Tailwind because it works. You should try it too. Go to tailwindnutrition.com or you can go to our partners page. You get a link in there and give it a try.
The Tailwind Challenge, right, Scott?
Can't lose.
So great value, and they stand behind their wind.
Like a tail. You know, there's a little bit of excitement when I go to the mailbox and I pull out the mail, and among all the bills, there is a nicely crisp, clean, white envelope that has my name on it. And in the upper left-hand corner, it says Ultra Running Magazine. Mm. And I just think it's Christmas one more time. 11 times a year, I get Christmas. And I get to open that magazine. I get to see some great photographs. I get to read some great educational articles. I get to look at the latest race results. It's one of the favorite things about going to the mailbox, Don.
You know, you can't beat print. Right, there's just a good feeling about thumbing through the next page and
dog-earing the articles that you like or the gear you want to try.
They've done a great job over there. They've reformatted. A new format is out there, and it just looks great.
It is. We love those guys over there. We think they do our community a great service. If you're not subscribing and you even walk the trails, you need to have this magazine in your library.
I would venture to say they're the original Trail Runner Nation podcast, really, because they go for content regarding how to become a better runner. There's how do you use an aid station? That type of stuff is in there. So it's really an instructional how-to.
It is. Go to trailrunnernation.com, click on the partners page, and you can get a discount on this great resource.
Ultra Footwear, A-L-T-R-A, Scott.
UltraRunning.com is their website. You can also get to their website by going to our partners page. They make great shoes. They're zero drop. They are foot shape design, which makes them fit your foot.
I'm currently.
Why wouldn't anybody that makes shoes make them the shape of your foot,
Scott?
Why is that unique?
Would you run in a set of cowboy boots, a pointed toe with a big heel? Of course you wouldn't.
There's a reason why cowboys limp, Don.
Yeah.
Anyway, one thing that I was not aware of until you brought it to my attention is not only do they make great running shoes, but they make everyday shoes. In fact, they have two different models in four different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at them right now. The Instinct Everyday, the Instinct is one of their running shoes, but the Instinct Everyday, that thing looks pretty cool.
Well, you know, there's a reason behind the design, and it's just not for the trail. It's also for the office.
It's life, Don. It's all about life.
It's instinct. Why do you think they use the word instinct, Scott?
I have no idea.
Well, go back and listen to some Mark Cucuzzella. You need to be in touch with the ground so you know what's going on. So everyday instinct.
Go to our partners page and click on over to Ultra and get yourself some great footwear. You won't disappoint.
Are we recording? Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
We are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Lee McKinley.
Andy Jones Wilkins.
And Trayson.
Well, welcome and welcome, group. We're missing Scott War today. He's off vacationing, and his vacation included some running shoes and paddle boards. So it's a working vacation for him.
Wow. All right.
So we'll miss him and some of his comments. We have a very, very fun topic and one to discuss. And I'm not really sure where it's going to go. And that's part of the fun of this conversation. But I've been thinking about it for a while. And that is, what makes us go as ultra runners? When it starts to hurt and we're out on the trail and all rational people would say, well, you shouldn't keep going. We do keep going. And what is it that makes us go? So I think that's one of the places we want to start. Alex Varner, he went out there on Facebook as we put a message out there. Hey, we're going to be talking about this. And he wanted to remind us, and I think a good disclaimer, that there are times that DNFs are medically necessary. We don't want to run on an ankle that is swollen and isn't working. If we're metabolically crashed, we don't want to push our bodies if the medic says you need to sit down. So there's a prudent time to go ahead and say, cut the band, I'm done today. So I think as we start this podcast and talk about what drives us and how we should push and how there are super tough people that have done things, there are super tough people that have also called it a day so that they have another day. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to bring up as a disclaimer. So welcome to the panel for this discussion. Where do we go from here, guys? Who wants to start off and who has an initial thought? Lee?
Well, I'll tell you what excited me about having Andy and Ann here tonight is just the depth of the years that we collectively have together with this sport. And to really take that subject that you're talking about and layer it on how things have changed over the years in terms of how people say, Ann, when you first started running in the 90s.
80s, thank you very much.
All right, how about the 80s? I was just trying to be kind there.
Go for the 80s, man.
Well, late 80s. Yeah, you don't have
My
to
first
claim.
Opener was 1985. Like, that was a hard one, I'll tell you.
So how have things changed? So, Ann, maybe you can answer this to start. How do you think that runners have changed or the sport of ultra running has changed?
You still have to use your 2 feet.
Yeah.
That's true.
And your legs. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of really good advances in the nutrition and the equipment. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, when I did it, there was something called erg that tasted like sweat. And people ate dates. And that really was called a crash-o-matic. Because, I mean, erg was so bad. When the first time I tasted it, I was running with this guy. I said, it tastes like sweat. And he says, what do you think it is? So they basically took the formula of sweat and they didn't like put any flavoring in it. It was horrid. So now you have so much options and you can figure out, I mean, just, and people are nutritionally, like what they're doing at Goo and Goo Science and a lot of other places too. But helped us. Yeah, the nutrition's really helped. And oh my God, you don't have to carry a fanny pack anymore. Hallelujah on the vest things. My goodness. Mm-hmm. And the clothes. Oh my gosh. I mean, things are just, but you still have to still do running. I mean, ask Andy, you still think you have to run? So, we didn't have like wings or something anymore. I don't know.
Andy, do you see any changes in the sport? Or is it like it was back in the 80s?
I see similar changes that Ann sees as well, but also, on the competitive side of the field, one of the things that saddens me, and I've talked a little bit about this on this podcast before, is that we see more people coming and going from the sport more quickly. And I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if they're going on and doing different things or becoming interested in other sports or seeking other pursuits, or if they're quite literally maybe getting burned out. But, you know, the Ann Trason 14 consecutive or 14 wins at Western States, including many, many top five overalls, seem to be a thing of the past. And that just makes me wonder about what bring to the sport that might be negative. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that people are running as I'm tired of that term and I almost hate to use it, but as a bucket list item, I want to run an ultra and claim an ultra as part of my personal resume. And once they've done it, they're in and out, and that's, and they move on to next. Do you think there's more of that because of the popularity and the media that covers these races a bit more, and the books that have been written, et cetera, that provide a little more exposure? Yeah, Ann?
I don't see what's wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone's like, honestly, I just think this is all really positive. You're bringing a lot more personalities in there. There's mm-hmm. a lot different things. It's like if someone wants to try it and they don't like it, you know, it's not like prison or something. It's not mm-hmm. like you try an ultra and you have to do it 14 times. Maybe they did it once and they said, whoa, I'd rather ride a bike. Look mm-hmm. at mm-hmm. Lee here. He rides a bike more than I do. It's not like he's like saying, well, Ann's not riding Davis double anymore, poo on her. I don't know. I just kind of look at everything kind of more positively. I go and say, it's great that people want to try it. It's not for everyone, but what's so cool is you don't have to hide it anymore. When I did it, you kind of like hid. You didn't want to tell anyone. Now people are like, oh, did you know about the 200? I mean, like, it's really empowering. You can just go and say to your neighbors, I just moved. And they're like, oh, you run hundreds. Okay. And I was like, whoa. I was telling someone, 1 year I ran one Western States and had my Cougar, and I left it in the car because I didn't want to. I saw my neighbors gardening, and I didn't want them to ask what I got it for. And I just left, like, all my running stuff, and I ran in the house and just, like, got it the next day when no one was out gardening. I mean, that's, like, now it's like, oh, they'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. You won Western States. Okay, now what?
I like that. I agree with that comment, Ann. I think the more people that try it once may try it twice, three or four or five times. You don't know till you get out there. So I think there's something to be said for, you know, bringing a lot of people through that funnel and to see how many people spit out the end and stay for a little while.
Is there any chance that some of this has to do with, and I don't want to focus too much on Western States or 100 milers per se, but let me go down that road for a minute.
The trail.
Thank you. Now that it is so much more, exponentially more difficult to get into states, you know, I don't know, Andy, is this part of why you've observed more people getting out of the sport? Is that they get into Western States, they know that they might never get in again. That they mm-hmm. try, but they see that, boy, I was lucky to get in 2014, probably never get in again, so I'm going to go on to something else. Does that hold water?
Well, it might. I don't think that's as much the case, though, as, I mean, a lot of people are making that's the part, a little bit, that's a bucket list thing Don was mentioning. People know if they're only going to get in once, they're going to make it count. They're going to bring their whole family out there. They're going to spend a week in Tahoe. They're going to, you know, really embrace the experience. But I don't know if that's necessarily the reason why people might be coming in and going out of the sport. I think I kind of agree with Ann that if, you know, there's no reason to force people to run 100 milers if they don't want to do it anymore. I think for me, what I struggle with is when I see, you know, talent come into the sport or great things that make a huge dynamic impact on the sport. Then either have a negative impact on it or they just go away. That it makes me sad. It doesn't make me feel as though they should or shouldn't have done that. But the part I like about ultramarathon running is that it values and it actually places a great deal of significance on being consistent, being a hard worker, being persistent, coming back year after year after year. Whether it's to a single event or just to your favorite trailhead. And that's a little bit of my concern about the bucket list thing.
Hey, Andy, I think that you've brought up something very important. And the skills that we learn and develop and practice and are the determination and the perseverance and making it through the tough times. We learn some of those skills or hone them on the trail, and how that can relate or we can utilize in real life, because life will hand you some hard climbs and some heat and et cetera. I know that I have learned determination and how to endure in my life based on being out there on the trail. So I like your observation.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody experience the some skills learned from the trail and bring it to your everyday life?
You know,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from Ann or Andy stories on the trail where they had to dig that deep, where they think they may have learned something. So
yeah.
please tell.
Oh, probably the one time. Well, I mean, it was a lesson. I don't know. And I used it with Casey. Poor little Casey. She's his friend. She's a border collie freak, too. So she came into Michigan Bluff, and she looked as bad as I did the first year I finished. And a friend, I sat down in an ice chest, and I was like, it's really hot. And he just looked at me, and he never cusses, but he cussed at me. And he says, you think it's only hot for you? And it's like Velcro. Some things that happen on the trail, I feel like they're just Velcroed on your brain. They become part of your neurological pathways. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't, but that's how it feels like to me. And I used it on Casey because she was like, oh, my stomach hurt. And I just said, you know, my good friend Earl, he was an athlete, but he never ran and really did a lot of running. And I said, do you think your stomach only hurts for you? And then I started laughing. And I gave her a little kit, what I thought might help, but it's like something you learn. It's like, yeah, you know, you signed up for it. You got to deal with it. And I think that's with life. You know, you're kind of in life, you got to deal with it. You kind of try and problem solve. I call it the P's of ultra running. You know, you problem solve, you persevere, you plan. I don't know. I have all these P's. I can't remember them all today, but
<That's good. laughs> there's more than three.
Trail.
There's more than three, but there's always three that apply.
Well, that's what I learned from Andy. He's like, you think of three things that will happen to you, and then you it just gets in your neurological pathways, because you learn after you've done a lot of these, I think. And I really credit Andy to telling me this. And I do it too, but I was shocked that he did it. Like, you're out there the week or two before states, and you're like, okay, what could happen, and how will I deal with it?
Yeah.
And I think that's really great in life too. You're kind of like, well, this is going to happen. How am I going to deal with it? You know, are you going to just sit there on the ice chest and say, wow, poor me? Or are you going to, like, try and make the best of it and make it to Forest Hill? I don't know.
It definitely builds self-confidence and the ability to know that when things get tough, you know, I can dig down and do it. And until you're put to that test, you don't really know who you are. And you can find out who you are on the trail.
Hey, Andy, speaking of that, a lot of us mid-packers think that you elite runners don't experience the same level of pain and don't go to those depths that we mid-packers do. What's your experience with that? How deep have you had to dig?
Well, I think that pretty deep, but I think that what people closer to the front of the pack, at least if they're able to stay toward the front of the pack, are able to do is get out of the bad patches more quickly.
Yeah.
Than perhaps others. I think Ann and I are kind of in the same boat on this, that we were, neither of us, especially, you know, growing up and in our early, you know, whatever, running life, were, you know, world beaters with huge VO2 maxes or anything like that. But we were just able to keep going more than the other guy and gal, and especially keep going when it got really, really bad. And I think my golden nugget is, it's like you guys were just saying, it's bad for everybody. Everybody has blisters, everybody's throwing up, and everybody's quads are shot. So don't even talk to me about how bad that is. I think instead, just get through it. I have seen the most successful mid-packers to become more front-packers are the people who figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge, but it also gets to this notion of what keeps us from dropping out, too, because you are then at that point where you're battling whatever sort of extrinsic forces are out there. You know, I've paid for all my crew to be out here. My mom is watching at home on the internet. My whatever, with the intrinsic desire to just finish the race and get it done. And what is going to be more, you know, especially if you have to readjust your goals and go from maybe trying to be in the top 10 to trying to just get a sub 24 to trying to just finish before 30 hours. And I think the mental toughness that's required when you are readjusting your goals and expectations in the context of both external and intrinsic rewards can be overwhelming to some people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's true for running and life.
Yeah, well put.
I think, though, that's what makes ultra running different than a 10K, and that's why I love the sport, and that's why I'm really glad you're hitting on it. Because the first usually some of the first people never have a bad patch. But I can talk to the last place finisher at States and have a great conversation about what I went through. I could not talk to someone who just won a 10K or set a world record or a marathon, like someone who ran like a 203. I'd be like, I wouldn't even be able to comprehend what kind of training they do. But ultras, you really have like this huge broad spectrum, and it makes it easy. It encourages people to go out in groups, and you become family. And I don't know if that's so true, and it might just be my arrogance and bias, but I don't feel that way so much in a 10K or even cycling, sorry. But yeah, it's just I think it's one of the cool things about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what I've noticed is, and we've talked about it before, at least if not on the podcast, at least amongst runners, that somehow the trail filters out and finds optimistic people. You don't find a lot of negativity out there on the trail, and so like-minded people that when things get tough, they look for that silver lining, and sometimes that lining can be a very thin lining, but they'll find it, and they'll support one another, and they won't, because if you've ever run with someone that is speaking negative and is a person that doesn't have that positive energy, they're not a training partner, and they're not someone you'd want to run a long ways in a race, because they'll start to bring you down a bit. And they usually don't stick around the sport that long, because there's a lot of adversity and there's a lot of things to complain about. And so we end up with a lot of bib wearers and racers and training people that are training that are just nice, nice people and very positive and easy to get along with. And that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's part to Ann's point. You know, they're good people that are out there running these distances.
Although I paced this guy at TRT, and he got so negative that he said something I was really embarrassed about. I mean, it was really good, and then he just got really bad, and it was like so – there was nothing I could do. The poor guy was like – he kept talking about how he was going to die. But after 8 miles going into incline, I just turned to him, and I was shocked. I kind of felt bad, but then the next person said the same thing to him. I said, hey, dude, you're going to die, but not today.
Good point.
And then I felt so bad, because I was like, I really like was supposed to be helping him, and I was like, I am so done with you, because you're like so negative.
Maybe that's what he needed to hear.
Now he dropped out, get this, at mile 93. It was horrible. Yeah, and then now my friend who I talked into helping him, like from 80 on, Jim, we were like so depressed. We were like depressed for a week. Because you get him that far and you're like, wow.
Yeah, I'll bring up something about the DNF. We know that it's called Do Nothing Foolish, and we've heard that term. But I would venture to say that we've all, even if we do not have never had our band cut and officially dropped from a race, and there's no shame in that, and we talked about that at the beginning, but I don't think there's many races that I've started out with finishing the plan that I had, that they've all been somehow changed a bit. So I've never, the do not finish applies, heck, if I've gone out there and it took me 8 hours longer than I thought to run 100 miles, that is essentially a DNF, but I've just slogged through it. I mean, I didn't finish the race that I planned to, so I think that there are a number of ways that you have to manage the not completing what you set out for. So just because you finish through, which is a great thing to achieve, I also think that we as finishers sometimes come up a bit short on our A goal, and something to think about.
Well, that's why I tell people that I work with to write out three things when they're done with the race, three things they learned, because even when they drop out, I said, don't make a did not finish become a did not learn. And I think what you just said now was totally cool. Oh, that's my dog. That's his. Oh, there's an ambulance. Isn't that cool? That's so cool. She's serenading an ambulance. Sorry. But yeah, I think that even if you're 8 hours short, I have people write that up whenever they do their race report. There's a little different. It's like you write three things you did right, three things that you could have learned from it, and three things you'd do differently.
Do they have to start with?
I have them like file it in every race they do, and I make them read it before they do their next race. It's so fun. And I learn a lot from the people. I mean, it's amazing. It's kind of cool. I'm easily entertained, obviously.
Uh-huh. At the risk of taking this in a little bit of a different direction here.
We don't have a direction, Mac.
All right. So this is
have at it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's an open water swim.
Yeah, right. So ultrasignup.com. We all know the site. It's something that is new to the sport relative to, you know, comparing back to the 80s and 90s. Something that's very unique about having that website is that now they're – if you use it in a certain way, you get on there and you can see how all of your fellow compadres are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, you can see you're ranked against everybody else. I'm interested to know from Andy and Ann, do you think that changes the sport? Or maybe to say it differently, do you think it attracts a different kind of an athlete now that we have that kind of data? And a site like that is really our one-stop shopping for seeing how we're doing in the sport.
Or even race selection. Can I put that in there before they tackle that? You may just choose some smaller pond races so that your ranking is higher.
Your ranking is higher, yeah. Do y'all think that changes the sport, or what do you think?
Well, I'll jump in on that and say first that I've actually enjoyed a rather precipitous decline in my ranking. Not that I followed that much, because, of course, I started – my career. I wish Ultra Sign Up existed when I started, because they came midstream. So it's so funny to see yourself plummet, you know, below 90%, 80 and 85. And so I take a certain amount of that with a grain of salt, as I'm sure Anne does. I'd be curious to hear what she has to say, because she had like a perfect ranking until a couple of years ago, but
yeah.
She might have not even known what it was a couple of years ago. On the flip side, I do think there are people who really pay attention to that, much like they might pay attention to their USA Cycling ranking on, mm-hmm. you know, as a Cat 4 racer, road racer, mountain biker. And that, I mean, that's an interesting piece of data, and it's valuable and so forth. But what bugs me a little bit about it is that, I don't have empirical data on this, is that people will, especially on the front end of a field, will drop out of a race mm-hmm. That they're not going to win or finish in the top five rather than finish the race that would therefore tarnish their Ultra Sign Up ranking.
You think that's going on?
Well, yeah, I do. Huh. I do.
Can I just interject on that thought so we don't lose it? Do you think there should be some type of penalty, essentially, on your ranking if you decide to throw the race? Or do you think that would push us into unsafely finishing races? That's a dangerous slope.
There is, right? There, you get a big uniquely colored, is it in red? A DNF on your Ultra Sign-Up list.
Does it change your ranking, though?
Ah, good question.
I don't know that.
No, it doesn't. It just lists you as having DNF'd. And I don't want to belabor this point, because I've been a longstanding opponent of DNFing. I wrote an article maybe 5-6 years ago about the Ultra Running Magazine rankings and whether or not voters should put into their consideration whether runners DNF'd. And I remember at the time, Don Allison and John Mettinger, it was in the transition of the magazine, said, well, we don't have reliable data on DNFs. Mm. And they don't. So, you know, even back then, it was very difficult to use DNF data as a way of measuring an athlete's high level of performance. That said, you know, I think that there are runners now who will take a DNF rather than take something that might hurt their ranking. I don't think they're vocal about it, and I certainly don't think they're, you know, doing it. They're, you know, throwing races, but I do think that if we are going to take this ranking thing seriously. And right now it's just Ultra Sign Up, right? It's one website basically run by a small group of people that everyone, you know, clings to for just about every bit of data. I think we ought to, you know, really figure out a good empirical way to do it, and a way that's honest, sincere, and covers all the races. I mean, right now you don't even get all the races into Ultra Sign Up. And so I think that's a Pandora's box that's yet to be fully opened. On the DNF thing, certainly I don't want people, you know, sticking races out when they have a career threatening injury. But I also think it's important for everyone who enters the sport of ultra running to realize that you're going to feel miserable. You're going to have pain. You're going to go through a whole bunch of, you know, your version of hell. And the best ultra runners are the people who get through it and are able to finish. And whether that makes you a 92%er or a 62%er really shouldn't matter all that much.
Mm-hmm. Well put.
Did you want Ann to comment on that? Ann, did you have anything to contribute on that?
I must just be weird because I look at it completely different.
Well, that's what the podcast's about. Tell us how you look at it.
I don't look at Ultra Sign Up that much. It's a monopoly. It's like whatever. You know, I ran because I wanted to do it against Ann. And all these people are now looking at it, and they bring this up, and I'm like, well, who are you really running for? Are you running to make Ultra Sign Up happy, or are you making yourself look happy? I mean, it's a bar. You could have it as a bar. If that motivates you, great. You might set another bar. If I break, like, whatever hours, 20 hours, I get a pizza. I don't know. To me, does it make any difference? People bring it up, and I'm like, wow, my brain must really work differently than most people, because I just think it's really cool you're going out and testing yourself. And that's the kind of person, that's what I try and convey to the people that I work, you know, that I'm working with, my friends. It's like, hey, you should be doing this for yourself. Why do we care so much in life what other people think? But again, you know, maybe I'm a little eccentric.
So do you have a question?
Oh, I only want to say that anybody that wants to look at Ann's results would be, I don't know that there are any results better. If you were to look at Ultra Sign Up, it shows her modesty in saying what she just said, that I think they're what, all 100%?
People really don't believe me, but when I was out there, and because I was really shy, I just didn't feel like vocal, and people didn't want to hear it. But seriously, when I was out there, I just wanted to do the best Ann could do. I didn't want to be judged against some guy. Ooh, really? Like, would you have a daughter and you want to say, hey, go see what your standard is against Bob, little Bob down the street? No, you want your daughter or your son to be the best that person can be, not as a runner, but as a person. And I've used ultra running, I hope, to make me a better person. And that was my goal, not just a better runner, but a better person when I'm under stress. And that's what I took out of the sport. So, but I know I'm a little eccentric and, you know, but I wasn't like I was racing again. I mean, people all like, oh my goodness, people like the Tara Mara thing. That wasn't what I was thinking about in Leadville, but I was afraid to ever say it. So anyway.
If for those that are listening that haven't gone to Ultra Sign Up and put Ann's name in there, it is worth the journey of doing that. It's quite astounding. Your mouth will drop open. And I hope I don't embarrass you by saying that, Ann. It is quite an achievement what she's done. And she is so humble and modest about that accomplishment. So
you're just being way too nice. But seriously, when I was out there, I wasn't thinking about what anyone else, you know. Well, that's not true. Like, I mean, Leadville was so funny. This whole thing, the Born to Run, really, Don Cardon was there, and I had like a crush on him. So it was like I didn't want to embarrass myself and get the pukes, and then have him write about it in Runner's World. That's the real truth.
Isn't that funny?
I really
the things
cared.
That motivate us on the trail.
Yeah,
it's like it's all different. Seriously, I was like, I'm gonna get sick. And that's going to look really bad for, like, because the guy's covering it that I idolized. So I don't know. We all have different – I think what you need to do when you're out there running, I really think it helps, at least what I think, is to find out what motivates you. If Ultra Sign Up motivates you, great. If not throwing up in front of your someone you idolized in high school motivates you, great. I don't know. But I'm eccentric. I realize it. So –
Hey, Don.
Yeah.
I got a new Trail Runner Nation hashtag.
Oh, I'm ready.
Hashtag don't get the pukes. I mean, yep. it don't get the pukes. I love it.
I don't think it'll be as big as Sia in Squaw, which has gone viral and taken over the trail community, which is is also one of your.
I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, it was a great one. So I'm going to bring up a topic, and this is one that I wish I could think through and maybe bounce it off somebody before I say it, because I'm not sure how it's going to land. But I would say out of the four of us that are here, we've probably run our fastest race at maybe behind us, with the exception of Lee, who seems to keep getting faster. And there are plenty of people that are listening to this that are going to have their fastest races are behind them. How do you or how do we process that when we're no longer running X time, but now we're a bit slower? How do you internally accept that, and how has it become okay with you? And how can you still line up on the starting line and really feel challenged and okay with not being in that same place? And so Lee's given me it's okay that I ask that, so I feel a little bit better about it. Does anybody have any experience with it or thought about it? Okay, Andy.
I've thought a lot about it because my fall has been more precipitous than most. I was running in the top 10 in Western States in 2010, 2011, and I got two more finishes in 13, 14. And, my body, I got to my mid-late 40s, issues that I know had been around that I'd been running through, like serious issues, hip problems, knee problems, things that I'd been frankly ignoring and running through for a long time, finally caught up to me. And frankly, it was hard, even in 13 and 14, to be, I didn't have bad races. I was under 20 hours both times, but it was hard for me to not be in the mix for the top 10 and all that. And since then, so now a year and a little bit since then, I've even, deteriorated more. And yet my love for running has actually increased because the pressure valve was off on being a competitive runner, the need to have any sort of external gratification was long in the past, and I was able to just savor running, and most of all, and you're getting me fresh off of this, I was able to spend 3 weeks this summer completely engrossed in Western States and Hard Rock as a spectator and a volunteer and a participant in the sport, not as a runner. Mm-hmm. And it was in that experience that I realized, there's still a place for me in the sport. So selfishly, it was like, okay, there's still a place for me here. But more kind of altruistically, there's still the love of what it means to run 100 miles or 50 miles or 50K or 10 miles. And it doesn't matter how fast you are or slow you are or young you are or old you are. If you love it and cherish it and savor it, you're all part of the tribe and the club and the group. And you can hug everybody and you can share stories and you can be on the trail together. And that has made it much, much easier, you guys, to sort of reconcile the fact that truly my best race is behind me. And I was less okay with it 2 years ago than I am now, and that makes me, able to put one foot in front of the other a lot easier now than before.
That's a great story.
Yeah, one of the things that I appreciate about this sport is once you are, I don't know your fastest time, Andy. What was your fastest time at States? You were 17s something?
Yeah, 16:39.
Oh, I apologize for not getting that 16:39. But when you are that person, regardless of how far you are away from it, you still carry that mantle of he's a 16-hour runner or he's a sub-24 guy. It doesn't matter if you're two decades from that. You still hold that accomplishment, and I perceive people in their finest year not where they are, because I know they've done it, they have the knowledge, they have the experience, they've run that pace, and so I really see them as that runner and never judge of saying that runner has fallen. Not at all. That runner is a 1639 guy. You know, Andy Jones Wilkins, he's a 1639 guy. Amazing. Doesn't matter what you're running today. So that's how I perceive our community. And I think it's kind of cool that I think others kind of look at that way too. I hope. Mm-hmm. I hope. I have seen for myself to address that faster days. I think I'm trying to rationalize it by it was really hot. I'm looking for all excuses. I didn't train as well as maybe. I don't think I've placed it on the age grouping as much as I'm trying to find environmental factors.
Yeah, yeah. I clearly, even my most recent race at Tahoe Rim Trail recently, stick my head clearly in the sand with my age, and I just go out way too fast only to learn about mile 25 is like, oh, I'm really not the same runner as I used to be. How come all these young runners are passing me now?
It is amazing to watch youth out there and how quick they recover and how just fresh and green in a positive way that those bodies are that,
right.
Just move through that stuff. So, one of the things we had Faster After 50, we had the author of that. That was a good podcast to talk about, even though age does move along, that we can plateau and hold on to some strong performances. And so there's it's not like you're over the hill just because you hit a certain landmark. Fast After 50 by Joe Friel was the podcast in the book, and I think a good one.
You know, so. But for me, I have gotten more back and more enjoy. I've gotten more enjoyment in the last couple of years from helping people than I ever did running. And it's been a real gift. And the volunteering, and I know it sounds, kind of whatever, but seriously, I really feel like I've been given this huge gift, that I'm more excited when someone runs 29:45 and I've been working with them for 6 months and I ever felt about my own accomplishments. And it's true. It's like I've shed more tears with people crossing the finish line. I don't think I ever really cried in any of my runs, but in the last couple of years, well, when I finished UTM, whatever that Idaho thing was, I Am Tough, I cried there because I didn't think the finish line. I thought the finish. I'd never get to the finish line. But just the people I've run with and seeing what they've gone through and the pride I've had for what they've gone through, it's more emotional. And it's. I really thank all those people that have allowed me to share their journey with them.
So, Anne, what have you learned coaching that you didn't know as a runner? Is there some things you picked up on or lessons?
You could write a book on it. I mean, it's just because you're seeing it from a different perspective, and I've learned a lot about myself. People have learned a lot about them. There's when you really click with someone as an athlete and a coach, it's special, and you really grow, and you become better, the two of you than single. I mean, that's what I mean, when the people I've been working with, it's amazing. It's like a rediscovery of both people. And sometimes maybe two heads are better than one. I don't know, like four legs. I don't know what but I was like running with Ken Michaels, all day Ken, and having him, like I told him, I looked at it. I just didn't want to be out there. I was being selfish. I didn't want to be out there the second day in the heat. So we got to the river and I said, dude, you have to do this in 6 hours. And he did like 5:45 or something. And I was like, and I thought he'd talk the whole time. He didn't talk at all. He just really, I couldn't believe how hard he worked, and it was incredible.
That what you're bringing up now goes back to the original theme of this podcast is about what drives a ultra runner to keep going, and so it sounds like you have some experiences coaching where you've observed some of these runners digging deep and going further.
Yeah, and that's the what I work with. Is what when you're working with someone, a lot of it's mental and what's going to motivate that person. And that takes months to develop. You kind of have to get to know the person, what motivates them, what doesn't motivate them, so that's kind of a joy, and every person's different. And when you're out there and you're really on redlining it, like even if you're 29:45 person, you're really getting to know that person pretty well. it's a gift. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask the three of you, does your motivation, what motivates you, that item, does that change as your running career has changed, as your race changes, that how much in flux is that reason? Mm-hmm. And do you know your reason every time you step up to a race? Anybody want to start with that?
You know, if I could.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about a specific event, Angela's Crest. Mm-hmm. And I think you know this story. Several years ago, had a full crew with me, and I made it to mile 75. Anybody that knows Angela's Crest knows that mile 75 is where the race really starts. A lot of climbing mm-hmm. there, and just getting to that point is pretty laborious. So mm-hmm. I happened to get that to that point, and I was done physically and emotionally. And so there, if you could picture me sitting, laying on a cot with a sleeping bag very comfortably over me with a pillow, eyes closed, and I could hear my crew in the background saying, okay, it's time to pack up, time to get going. Lee, Mac, he's not going anywhere. We're done.
Yeah.
And I don't know what changed, and I can't point to if it's that specifically, but something definitely changed at that very moment when I heard that. And I got right up at that point and said to my pacer, Drew Reynolds, a good friend of mine, said, it's time to go. And so we just got up and went at that point. And I, to this day, I want to say that maybe it was the humiliation of hearing the crew talk about the potential of dropping out that drove me to get up. But it's just weird, you know, to back to your question about what makes you get through that point. I think it differs in every race. But in that case, it was just that, I think Andy brought it up too, that it's that point where you know that a lot of people were counting on you to do something, and to give up at that point was just too, this may be below the belt, but just say humiliating. I just couldn't put up with that. So got up and went, and something switched in the brain, and I continued on. So
did you run for you or run for them?
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to the point that it felt like a physiological difference happened. That it wasn't like a decision like, oh, my gosh, I now need to do this for my crew. Mm-hmm. I felt that the body just changed at that moment, like a light switch went on when I heard that those comments. So I guess the answer to the question would be that I was doing it for them at that point, that I didn't want them coming all that way to see.
Well, so that's funny. Physiologically, you didn't change. Whatever metabolically was happening was the same, but your brain switched. So there was something in your mind that changed. So how much of a DNF is between your ears, and how much is, you know, between your torso is always interesting to think about and wonder. Yeah, Andy.
I'd like to pick up on that, Lee. That's a great story, and you're absolutely right. When you get to Chantry at AC, all bets are off. But I'd like to kind of tie together the two pieces of Ann Trason that are so inspiring to me, because I think what she's exemplified both as a runner and now as a post-competitive runner and coach and supporter of other people is a really wonderful example of what motivates people. I mean, I think at the, you know, in the last 25 miles of a 100-mile race, you need whatever it takes to motivate. And, you know, in the early years of Ann's run at Western States, I'm sure she was motivated. She could tell this better than I, but I'm just going to do it. Motivated by desire to get better than last year's time, or, you know, race against Ann, as she said, or, you know, make inroads into, you know, the men's field like she did so well. And then also motivating her to make other runners better, more full, whether they're, you know, a second place finisher like Casey Lichtig this past year, or a 29-hour finisher. And for me, seeing that joy in Ann Trason's face after all these years is inspiring enough. But to do it in a way that really taps into what motivates us, because when you are on the cot at Cal 2, it's a whole lot easier to just pull that sleeping bag over and go to sleep, cut off the band, than it is to slog down to the river and get it done. Mm-hmm. When you're Ken Michael, who Ann paced in those and said, we got to get this done in 6 hours because I'm tired of being out here, you know, it's much easier to take the car back. Mm-hmm. And living in a world where people tend to take the easy way out, ultra running is such a place where, you know what, you got to take the hard way out. And whether you're a 15-hour runner or a 30-hour runner, the hard way out's the way to go. And I think that makes it better for us as runners and certainly better for us as people.
Yeah, and I think we're designed as humans to be able to pursue that or have the persistence or the determination to do that. Like you were saying, Andy, I'm not sure there's too many other places that really tap into that piece of us that pushes that far down. And unfortunately, right, there are some people with circumstances, either financially or at home or emotionally. I mean, there are places that we get pushed hard, but many of us are insulated from those because of the design of our society and what how we've tried to make it more comfortable. So I think as humans, probably in the past, we were pushed much more often than we are now. And so it's a familiar place for our gene pool to go into that deep, tough stuff and makes it okay and a welcome home, if you will, in some of those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Andy, do you have your, we'll kind of backtrack just a bit. What drove you? When you stepped up to the race line, what was your motivation? What was your reason to finish when things got hard? Did it change? Was it constant?
Well, I gotta say, I mean, in those years at Western States, I was, it was all about getting to come back next year.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with the race in 2001. I stayed away from it for a couple of years because I felt like I owed it to myself to learn how to run it. Got myself into the top 10 in 2004. And frankly, it was totally motivated by wanting to come back year after year after year. That's all I cared about. It was a single-minded, I admit it was a single-minded devotion. I didn't run any other race. I ran a bunch of other races, but every year Western States was my number one race. Even in 2009 when I also did Hard Rock and Leadville, it was just like, I am going to do this race. It's going to be the best thing I do that year. And I mean, even now that I'm not doing it anymore, it's still like Christmas in my house, you know, Western States weekend. And I like to think that kind of effort, throwing everything into an effort like that, helps you overachieve, because I do think I overachieved, especially in those last couple of years. But I think if you set your mind to something, you know, you say, well, I don't care if I'm 17th at Michigan Bluff. I guarantee those seven guys in front of me, something's going to happen to them, and I'll still find my way into the top 10 when all's said and done. And, you know, God willing, it'll happen. But that I was driven in those years, Don, to be honest, completely by that desire to come back the next year and be at Squaw and be able to do it all again.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, and of the runners that you're coaching, how many come in knowing their why or what drives them? Is that something you need to help bring out for them, or do they all come with their why?
You know, that's one of the joys I get about it, so I don't even ask it. I guess it's just, I'm just curious. So when someone comes to me, that's what I'm always looking at. What'll motivate them? Because it's just not the, it's a lot of the training. Mm-hmm. You know, races are one thing, but you want to be able to motivate someone to do the training, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and be able also to adapt to their living situation. I mean, a lot of people, you know, most people have, you know, huge family and trying to juggle all that and find out how, when things are really stressful, you might have 16 soccer games one weekend and you have to go out and do it. How can you be motivated when you're really tired to go out and do a training run? And a lot of it also is just telling people, hey, you can have that one day where you can be selfish and only about you. That's huge for a lot of people, you know, because you're not brought to really feel that way. And so that's one thing I work on, especially a lot with the women I work with, because they're not allowed to ever have that. So you can't just like start at the starting line and say, okay, this is my day. And that's a hard, hard one to overcome. And I'll spend like 6 months, a year with people trying to get so they don't feel guilty about it.
Interesting. I would say that's one of the things that I've observed and like to comment on now, is that it is a day that can be solely committed to, and nothing else in your mind except that race. You may have 100 things on your agenda, bullet points and items and things, but if there is one day where everything can disappear and not even enter that space, it's on that race day. And that's a real gift. And I've said it's much like being a 5 or a 6 or 7 year old when all you have to do that day is play, right? And nothing is of concern to you, zero, because there's nothing to worry about. And on race day, the only thing on that agenda is race day. And, you know, there aren't the PG&E or electrical bill or the problem at work. Those seem to be insulated from that moment. At least that's what I've experienced on that race day, because you're so concentrating on your effort and all the little details that need to be paid attention to so you don't go into, you know, the metabolic crash.
Well, I always say that, but the way I looked at it, because I always had that kind of like feeling like I shouldn't be there, like really make it like my day. I would tell myself it's a lifetime of experience. And I've said that before in one day. So I said, that's how I would do, because I did. I felt like really guilty. I'd have all this great crew, people be running around and people be all excited. And I did. I felt really guilty that people would be like driving all that way. And you're like, you'd see them for 90 seconds, mm-hmm. a minute. They drive all the way to Robinson Flat and you grab a bottle and you leave. How self-centered is that? So I like, I did. I played these games with, well, that's okay, because it's a lifetime of experiences in one day. So it's just, this is your life. And that's all I told myself. This is your life. How you want to play it is how you do it that day. And part of that's being nice to the people, your crew, being nice to the volunteers. It's how you really want to spend your life. But yeah. I had to learn those. That got motivated or allowed me to be that person. And it is self-centered. Let's be serious. Going out and running 100 miles that day, it is kind of self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm. But what I hear you saying, Ann, too, is that the people that do that have found their passion. And how fortunate to even know people that have found their passion, to be around you. You know, it goes back to what we're talking about with ultra runners being generally very positive people on the trail. Mm-hmm. Well, you found people that are devoting that kind of time because they love it. And who doesn't want to be around somebody that has found their niche?
Found their tribe. And we've talked about that before, the quilting tribe, right? There are quilters out there.
Yeah, the quilting tribe. But also, I always say it's more than running. It's a passion. And that's what I just think that and also then I got to this point where you're allowing, this is what I tell people, you are giving back by doing what you're doing and allowing people to help you. It is a gift to them. But yeah, it's a passion, and I think we're all really fortunate, because you're like, we're babbling on about the sport like this, and isn't that cool that we care that much about anything?
Yeah.
A lot of people don't care that much about anything, and I'm like, gosh, I mean, we're like crazy fanatics. We really care about the sport so much that, and it's, I think that's also another gift.
Well, good. I think we've hit this discussion pretty well. Does anybody have anything that was left on their docket that they wanted to discuss? Lee, you've got a 7 or 8 indexed pages over there with a full table of context.
I tell you, it was very fun. It was a great, great topic and covered everything.
Andy Jones Wilkins, anything left?
No. I'd like to just say one more time how excited I am that after several years away that we have Ann Trason back in our midst and sharing her wisdom and her knowledge and just her wonderful, infectiously positive attitude. I ran into Ann on the way down from Squaw Valley this past year at Western States. And it's, you know, Ann, we're so excited to have you back, and your energy and enthusiasm and love and zest for life and zest for running is going to keep us going many years into the future. So I'm just thrilled to have Ann back and to share a podcast with her, with you guys, is just great stuff. So thanks a lot.
Well put.
Yeah, well, I don't think we can get any better close than that. And do you have anything you want to add?
I know what Andy and Lee doing next, and you're doing next. I mean, come on, I'm doing some crazy stuff. I'm doing that ages thing. Oh my goodness! But now that the lists of talk about motivating. But no, seriously, what are you guys going to do next?
Well, Mac, you're headed up to Tahoe to do a triathlon, right?
Oh, I don't even like to admit that on a podcast of ultra running, but I've ventured into the Ironman scene, so yeah.
No, you've been there for a while. You've been to Kona two different times, one some time ago and one very recently. Mm-hmm. So you're quite an athlete, but not only on the trail, but in other disciplines too. You're just a machine.
I do sink in the pool.
You do. You don't have a lot of body fat on you, that's why. That's good. And if we want to find a coach, are you open for any coaching? Do you have any availability, or is there a long waiting list? How do we get a hold of you for some coaching if we want to be an Ann Tracen athlete?
It's morphing. But I'm really right now also trying to work with people and bring them kind of under an umbrella, like Dan Williams and people who would never try. So now my new thing is trying to get people who have all that knowledge to offer it.
And boy, does Dan Williams have it.
I mean, it's like, and he was my mentor. So what's really cool for me is I'm spending a lot of time like, okay, Dan, now you have to do this and please do it. And, it's just another avenue. It keeps growing. But, Andy, what are you doing next?
Well, you know, I'm maintaining my commitment to staying competition free through this year.
like that.
You're not going to go to the ages. Have you heard about that Gary Cantrell crazy thing?
Yeah, Bozanich told me about it.
Oh, is he going?
Yeah, he's going. Or at least that's what I heard. But no, I'm doing. You know, out here in Virginia, we've got a great thing going with our new running club, the Charlottesville Area Trail Runners, and I'm a member of the board. And we're just finishing up our summer trail series, and we're doing a half marathon in November. And I'm a race director of a big 100K, as you guys know. In March every year. So as far as my running, I'll probably jump into probably one of David Horton's 50Ks in the spring of 2016 and then figure out from there. You know, I keep building up my lottery tickets for Hard Rock because I want to go the other direction there, which will undoubtedly be much slower than I went the first time, which was in 2009. But other than that, you know, I'm just putting one foot in front of the other and keeping things rolling.
Well, Andy, you could just blame it on the direction if you're slower. So that's there's a comfort there. And that says something about trying other races because you don't have to compare yourself to prior events. And there's plenty of races to choose from out there. So that's good. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. What's our new Trail Runner Nation hashtag? Don't get pukey, right?
Get pukey.
Don't get pukey. So we'll get that going out there and see where that takes us.
Thanks a lot. Don't give me credit for that one.
So go out and don't get pukey. Moss. Let's get you guys trained up on that end piece. Where are you, Scott, when we need you?